Andrew. There was a very there was a good announcement. The Victorian Allied Health Professionals Association is announced that, along with other health unions, that they've managed to push back against state governments and employers' attempts to remove access to paid pandemic leave and special leave for healthcare workers. Now, this is really great for those who wanted to isolate for the full 7 days if deemed a household close contact. Now, you may not be aware, but some of the health services had already started to withdraw this entitlement, advising healthcare workers to use annual leave if they were needing to isolate in the instance of being close contacts. This gives you a stark realization of how workers are bearing the brunt and shouldering the heavy load of the COVID situation. But anyway, I talked to Andrew, and it was quite an illuminating conversation.
So my name's Andrew Hewitt. I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Allied Health Professionals, Victorian Allied Health Professionals Association. So that's the union who looks after allied health professionals across Victoria, radiographers, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, social workers, speech pathology, podiatrists, that sort of workforce.
Okay, and of course that means that your members are intimately involved in the outcomes for government COVID arrangements. What's been going on for your members?
Yeah, that's right, Annie. Our members are integral to the health services in general. I mean, it's impossible to be a patient and go through a journey in a hospital and not interact at multiple points through that journey with allied health professionals. And so we've been integral in terms of the COVID response. And so our members have been heavily impacted by the COVID, the pandemic, and by what's been applied in terms of the health response both at a state and a federal level. And, they're suffering burnout. We've lost staff, we've lost members. Our healthcare workers are walking away because they're so tired and burnt out, and they're frustrated because they've worked so hard for so long to get to this point, and now they see it as basically as the restrictions are allowing the infections to run rampant in the community, with the expectation that the healthcare workers are going to pick up the tab at the end of it.
It's really interesting, isn't it, that there's been no discussion, it appears to me, about ramping up or improving public health systems in response to the pandemic. There's been a lot of conversation about keeping supply chains going and big business retaining workers and hospitality retaining workers, but not much money going to public health resources. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, and it's a very valid and important point, in that if you don't look after the health sector, then everything else around it will collapse and fall down. And the focus, I mean, quite rightly so, at the moment is around keeping, trying to keep people at work across all industries, but importantly across, food supply chains and important infrastructures like power and transport and emergency services. But ultimately, as I said, the healthcare workers and the health services underpin all of that. And if you don't look after your health services, then the rest of the society, they've got nothing. There's no safety net there. There's nothing to capture them, and look after them if things go wrong. And that's what we're seeing at the moment, in that we're reaching and exceeding capacity of the health services, and they keep talking about hospital capacities, and they keep talking about how many ICU beds, and they can add more beds, they can buy more ventilators, but what they can't do is they can't produce the staff to actually to look after the sick people. And it's not all about ICU, it's also about the people who are in just in the wards, or the people who don't even get into hospital, those that are sick and at home and are requiring healthcare workers to go into the home or to check on them and provide services. And so they need to be looking at the limitations and not the number of beds or the size of the hospital. It's how many healthcare workers that you've got and how many of those healthcare workers are actually healthy and able to come to work. And that's the important number that they're just ignoring.
What are you hoping that you'd be able to get them to see? I mean, I know that wages and conditions have always been an issue in these areas, but ever since there's been this push to privatise, have government, have small government, that kind of thing, we're really reaching the end of the idea that the free market can actually maintain a public health system when it needs to respond to something of this nature. But even before that, it was a problem, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, and look, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, basically, the health system has been commodified over a long period of time. We saw it sort of develop in the 1990s in Victoria, where the Kennett government basically devolved the structure of the health system in Victoria, such that we've got over 80 individual hospital or health networks that do actually run as, basically like a business, and they've got their own boards and, they've got their own budgets. And so it's an incredibly fractured system. And in terms of the commodifying of health, that's, comes from a federal level where basically they look at the activity and the number of patients, and rather than actually, so everything's measured in terms of the dollar rather than on the actual care value or the health outcome for the patient. And that's a problem. And we're being punished by it. And at the moment, as you said, this is not something that's just happened during the pandemic. This is something that was been building up for many years, and the pandemic's just exposed those weaknesses and those vulnerabilities. We've been running the health system too lean for too long, and getting by, and constantly squeezing the health workers to get more and more out of them, and bring on the pandemic, and suddenly we realise that there is no more to give. And you can't squeeze any more out of them, and they're breaking as a consequence. And the health system is being exposed as being incredibly vulnerable.
It's interesting because they spend a lot of publicity time around talking about our heroes and all the rest of it. But words are cheap when when they're applying it to people's goodwill and their professionalism and the
Yeah.
reason for why they've gone into this area in the first place, which is that they need to, that they're endeavouring to be bring positive outcomes to the community. But when it comes down to it, if you've got politicians talking about dollars and cents, but then saying to your workers that are your members that it's all about you, you paying, picking up the tab. That's really what it is, isn't it? Picking up the tab.
Yeah, and the government and employers have preyed upon the goodwill of healthcare workers for far too long, and they've relied on them, accepting substandard outcomes and pay rates and doing unpaid overtime to make to keep the system functioning for far too long, and that goodwill has been all used up now, and healthcare workers are saying, enough is enough. And I mean, more broadly than just what's going on in the health sector, we're seeing, huge workforce shortages at the moment, and that's a huge problem. And what people are sort of not putting the pieces of the puzzle together in that, this is not just about getting through the next 4 to 6 weeks of the pandemic. We need to have a healthy workforce going forward into the future. And if we don't look after the workers, if we don't provide them with adequate supports, and at the end of the day, they need to pay their mortgages. So they need to have, good remuneration. Then they're going to walk away, and they're going to find something that's not as stressful and not as dangerous, or potentially pays better. And as a consequence, we're going to have trouble retaining these people. Some of these people take, 6, 7, 8 years to train and to be qualified. Then you've got years of experience on top of that, and we're looking at losing them, and we just can't easily replace them. And the replacement costs, far more than it does to actually invest in the workforce we've already got, and that's just simple logic would dictate that we should be, looking after our workforce.
You shouldn't have to scrimp on proper outcomes for the patients or the system.
No, and look, there's plenty of research that's been done to demonstrate that, investing in health is a good place to invest, because it returns. Not just for the outcomes for the people involved, but it returns to the community it returns to society, and you know, a healthy society is a more productive society. And so, this penny pinching in the healthcare sector is self defeating, and it's going to punish us all. And we're being punished now, through the tight approach that the governments have had over a long period of time, and that's resulted in inadequate resourcing in terms of the number of healthcare workers that we need to perform, the role that we need at the moment to deal with the pandemic. And I have, genuine fears about this going forward.
Would your organisation like the government to step up effectively and take a better approach at training, support, ownership of the public health system to get a better result?
I can't speak for all parts of the health sector, but from our point of view, from the allied health professionals, specifically in Victoria, at the moment we're going through enterprise bargaining for the next 3 or 4 year period, and it seems ridiculous that we're having to, almost barter for some minor improvements here or there, at the same time that we're meeting with the government to try and find ways, in workforce crisis meetings, to try and find ways to keep the system functioning by keeping people at work. So there's a complete disconnect at a governmental level between, the industrial side of the issues and just the basic delivery of service. And they're totally intertwined and they cannot be separated. If you're not paying people properly, if you're not providing them with the conditions that they need to do their job properly, then that you won't attract them and you will lose them. And that's, again, as I said, that's a pretty simple recipe.
Yeah, it's funny, because you'd think that if it was all about the free market and all the rest of it, that because there's a scarcity of workers, that you should be able to negotiate good conditions and higher wages in this particular situation. Wouldn't you think that would be the case?
Well, look, we've never seen an environment like the current one where there's such a demand on the workforce. So, the power at the moment is with the workers, but that's not being played out because they're so busy looking after their patients. They're so heavily engaged and invested in providing healthcare and looking after the well-being of their patients that they're not really looking at in that framework. But as unions looking after and representing healthcare workers, that it's our job to point out to the government at the moment, the power really is with the workers in terms of market forces, and so they really should be stepping up. The governments really should be stepping up and making a commitment to better outcomes.
So, is the government the biggest employer of these allied workers?
Oh, by far. The public health system is one of the biggest employers. On a state level, by a long shot. Yeah.
Okay, and the management's been devolved into these business elements, and therefore they've got fixed budgets, and then they cut whenever they're in trouble, they cut down on the conditions and pay of the workers. Is that how it works?
Yeah, to some degree, and it's not quite as simple as that, because ultimately the funding for these health networks comes from the state level. But the actual running and the distribution within the health service is the responsibility of that individual health service. But because of the fractured nature of the system in Victoria, when we're bargaining for allied health professionals in the public sector, we're dealing with, as I said, over 80 individual employers, yet they don't really have the ability or the capacity to commit to the outcomes because they're not providing the funding for those outcomes. So ultimately, that is the responsibility of the government, and so really only the government has that power to actually provide those benefits and those rates of pay improvements that we're seeking.
So what they've done is moved the negotiations one removed from the people who have actually got the power to make the decision.
I would go even a step further than that. So to explain the detail of it, so when to get down to the detail in the bargaining situation, there's a representative for the employers, so who's representing all of the hospitals. Then there's a representative from the government who would be from the Department of Health who would sit in. And then there's the union and members, bargaining reps, who would sit in. So that's the tripartite nature of the actual bargaining. But the representatives of the government who sit at the table, they don't actually have the authority to actually make those decisions. That has to go back to be approved by Treasury before anything's going to actually be approved. And so it's a process whereby the government manages to keep the negotiations at more than arm's length. There's those barriers that make it even more difficult to get outcomes. And so there's a disconnect. So the people who are making the decisions aren't even sitting at the table, and so that makes it very difficult to plead your case and to explain to them the importance of the claims that you're making.
I really wanted to understand what was going on for your members, and also it's bemusing to think that there's not enough money, for proper conditions and wages.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous because they've been. And it's not a case that there's not enough money, because they've been throwing money at the response. They've been outside of the budgeted and funded outcomes of enterprise agreements. They've been throwing money at programs to try and bridge the gaps and to try and plug the holes. They haven't necessarily been hitting the targets with them, and I've been expressing concerns about the fact that quite often our members because of the fact that we're not high profile, that we've not been receiving the benefit of a lot of those funding outcomes. As I said before, there's a disconnect between what's happening at an industrial level and what's happening at a health crisis level. And if they just took some of that money that they're throwing at the health crisis level and pushed it over into the, because they're not mutually exclusive. I'll be in a meeting, as I said, trying to give them ideas on how to keep people at work, and the next day I'll be at a meeting and they're saying, well, we don't have, what are you going to give up? What are your members going to give up to get this benefit? And that benefit was something as simple as access to a tea room or some lockers to put their personal effects in, things that you would think would be basic entitlements, but our members have not been getting access to, so we're trying to build them into their agreements so they've got better protections. But, when we raise them as claims, they said, well, what are the offsets? What are you going to give up so that we can fund them? Yet the day before, they were throwing millions of dollars at a welfare package, to provide free coffees or to provide access to counselling services because the healthcare workers are so mentally and physically damaged as a consequence of what they're doing. So it just doesn't make sense.
So what you're really saying is that these people are completely locked into some sort of human resources, but they call it people of culture now, training, that this is the only mantra that they can think in. They're completely inflexible in their understanding of the situation that they're in.
Yeah. So they're operating like silos. So the industrial part is operating different to the actual health part. But as I said, they're totally integrated because the health people working in health, they rely on the industrial part. That's how they get their benefits. That's how they get paid. That's how they get their lunch break. That's how they get their all of their entitlements. And so you can't divorce the two. Yet they're dealing with them totally separate. And if you bring up one aspect in the other meeting, I say, well, this is not the forum for that because that's industrial, so it has to be dealt with separately. But so yes, very, very frustrating. And so they'll be different. Well, and they're not always different teams either. There's sometimes that people are in both. I mean, obviously we are, because the union, we're in all, especially the leaders are in all of these meetings. But even from the government's point of view, you'll sometimes have people who are sitting in the IR meetings, also sitting in the health workforce meetings, and yet they won't allow you to, effectively what they would say, contaminate that meeting with the issues from the other meeting, sort of thing, which is just ludicrous because, as I said, they're not exclusive. They actually, there's this huge overlap, and there's a huge amount of interplay between the two, and that's been an incredible failure of the, partly the IR system, but also in the way the government's chosen to manage it.
Well, that's fascinating.
And I've raised that with them repeatedly, and it's fallen on deaf ears.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. That's Andrew Hewitt from, he's the Assistant Secretary at the Victorian Allied Health Professional Association. There were some other things that he brought up, which was fascinating to me too. The business about saying that close contacts can be only related to household situations rather than workplaces has some interesting ramifications, quite obviously, but one of them is that it no longer would fall into work cover situations, which is a pretty grim idea, isn't it? And the other thing to mention again is that that particular union plus other health unions have actually in Victoria been able to establish that paid pandemic leave, special leave for healthcare workers wanting to isolate for the full 7 days has been achieved. So that's an important victory.